Let's start with a little bit of background information. Could you state your full name?
It's Monahan Arthur P.
Okay, and your date and place of birth?
I was born in Brantford, Ontario on August the 17th, 1928, okay. Which makes me 65 and retiring from St. Mary's in about 2 months' time.
2 months. So, could you talk about your educational background a little bit?
Well, I was entered into the Ontario separate school system, St. Mary's separate school in Brantford, Ontario, finished 8 grades there, then enrolled in the Brantford Collegiate and Vocational Institute, where I took 4 years of the 5-year Ontario high school program. I took my fifth final high school year at St. Michael's College in Toronto. And then, in 1945, I think it was, enrolled at St. Michael's College, which is the Catholic Federated College at the University of Toronto. Received an honors degree in history and philosophy, 4-year program, graduated in 1949. Registered for graduate studies in the fall of 1949 at the University of Toronto, and the Pontifical Institute of Medieval Studies for graduate work in philosophy. Got an MA from Toronto in 1950, PhD in 1953, both degrees in philosophy. Licentiate in medieval studies with specialization in philosophy from the Medieval Institute in 1952. If you're interested in terms of professional career beyond that, I suppose that's something
you might want.
I took a first job, professional appointment, I suppose one might say. It was a job as far as I was concerned, at Marquette University in the fall of 1953. That's the late and unlamented Senator Joe McCarthy's alma mater. And I was there for 1 year. Left in the spring of 54, took an appointment at what is now, I think, called the University of St. Jerome's College in Waterloo, Ontario. It was then just St. Jerome's College, affiliated with the University of Ottawa, and located in Kitchener, Ontario. I joined the philosophy department at St. Jerome's in 1954, remained there until 1958, when I moved, family and I moved to Halifax, where I started at Mount St. Vincent, and I was at Mount St. Vincent in the philosophy department for 3 years, I think, and then I joined St. Mary's in the fall of 1960. Mm-hmm. My particular area of philosophical specialization is, as you would expect from my degree from the Medieval Institute, medieval philosophy. And more particularly, particularly in recent years, that is in the last 20 years, medieval political thought.
Mm-hmm. See, so what was the size of the philosophy department when you first came in 1960?
At St. Mary's, I joined, curiously enough perhaps, the Faculty of Education in the capacity of teaching the philosophy of education. I remained in the Faculty of Education for only 1 year, and then I moved to the arts faculty. And as I recall, at that time, there were 4 members of the philosophy department. 3 of them would have been, I think, Jesuits, and I think I was the only lay member of the department, although there had been lay members, whether more than one in any given year, I'm not sure, but I do know that there were previously lay members of the philosophy department, but I think I was the only lay member when I joined. Mm-hmm. The department grew quite rapidly during the 60s, as was the case with virtually every other department at St. Mary's and at other Canadian and American colleges. That was the boom time as far as increasing enrollment and corresponding increase in faculty. I think our maximum compliment in philosophy since I've been at St. Mary's was either 8 or 9. I'm not sure about whether or not it ever got to 9. If it got only to 8, we've now gotten back to a full complement of 8 only this year. Mm-hmm. And the numbers have been less than that, fewer than that, during the 70s and 80s.
So how have the size of the department in terms of classes and students changed?
Well, the philosophy department at St. Mary's, like the religious studies department, which was then the theology department at St. Mary's, when I first came, that would have been in the 1960s, was a much more active, essential component of the degree programs than is the case now, insofar as for all the degree programs, arts, science, and commerce degrees, all three degree programs, in the 1960s and until early in the 1970s, had both philosophy and theology as required courses for all students enrolled in all these programs. That meant effectively that there was much more philosophy being taught to larger numbers of students in terms of larger numbers as a percentage of the student population. Mm-hmm. Philosophy was taught to 100% of the students when I first went there. And nowadays, of course, the number of students who take philosophy, real philosophy, has distinguished from just taking the basic logic course, which is described and designated as a philosophy course, but I don't consider it real philosophy. But we had a very large number of students in a very small enrollment. Mm-hmm. The enrollment at St. Mary's, I think when I first went there, might have been 800 to 900, I'm guessing. But we would have had all of them in the philosophy department. So we had lots of students in philosophy. I think the the student registration in philosophy now, that is the per unit registration, number of students taking courses in philosophy by individual course registration in 1992-93 is probably, or was, probably fewer than 1,500. Might even have been as low as 1,250. Well, if we had a student population of 900 in the three programs in the early 60s, and they were taking, let's say, 2 or 3 courses each in the degree program, the arts students would have taken philosophy in each of their 3 years. I think commerce and science students in that period of time would have taken philosophy courses for at least 2 of their 3-year programs. So we would have had more student registrations in philosophy in 1960 with a student population of about 900 than we do now with a student population of, what is it, 3,500, 4,000 if you extract the part-time students. Mm-hmm. So the issue of department size relative to student population and students in the department is something which has moved in conflicting directions over the period of time that I've been at St. Mary's.
I see. So do you feel that your relationship with your students has changed over that 30-year period?
Well, the students have changed. Students, mm-hmm. Students aren't like they used to be. I don't say that with any great nostalgia, but the whole approach to philosophy now, and I think the students' perception of philosophy at St. Mary's now is significantly different than was the case 30 years ago. And the basic explanation for that is that our students nowadays, and I think the corresponding reaction of the institution,
And there's nothing peculiar about St. Mary's in this respect. I mean, St. Mary's has reacted to students in precisely the same way as virtually every institution of higher learning in this country has reacted in the last 20 years. We offer essentially a kind of a supermarket approach to students, meaning by that that students select their courses and the portion of a degree program which is a requirement, except in some particular areas, principally certain science programs and let's say accounting or something like that, in commerce, in the arts faculty, students take pretty well whatever they want to take. And philosophy isn't something that very many students want to take as a general component in their degree program. Whereas in the 60s, an arts degree had, I'm guessing now, but 15 to 20% component in an arts degree would have been philosophy. That was all there was to it. So students took philosophy because they had to. I don't say that people took philosophy courses when I was first at St. Mary's didn't enjoy them or didn't think that they were worthwhile. Some did, some didn't. But they didn't enroll in philosophy courses except for those who wanted to do honors work in philosophy. They didn't enroll in philosophy courses because they were enthralled with philosophy. It was just a part of the program, in the same way as a student nowadays who takes a commerce degree would wind up taking some accounting courses. There's no way around that.
Yeah.
That's all there is to it.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that that's the case, then the attitude of students toward their faculty and the attitude of faculty toward students, as far as philosophy is concerned, is much different now than was 30 years ago.
Yeah. So how have the course offerings and academic areas of the departments changed?
Well, when when we were providing a required program in philosophy, the departmental approach to the discipline was to expose our students. We knew we had them as a captive student audience for 3 years, let's say, just to talk about the arts faculty requirements to give specification. We knew we had them for 3 years, and we saw our job in the philosophy department as showing them what philosophy was all about, so that with the typical division of philosophy into a number of subject areas into which one can divide philosophy, the students got, if you would like to break it down into six one-semester courses, because many of the courses then, in effect, were semester courses, although they were always advertised in the calendar as full-year courses, but there would be an actual division course content, so that there would be, let's say, two subject areas in philosophy in a given full-year course, so that a student who was going the full route with three full courses in philosophy wound up taking six parts of what the department considered to be the slices of the philosophical pie. You just slice the philosophical pie into six parts, and each of the terms students were exposed to that particular subject matter. Nowadays, students, if they want to do major in philosophy or honors in philosophy, have a wide range of choice and really don't have to take very many courses that might be described as required courses. Mm-hmm. And students who don't want to major or do honors work in philosophy, but want to take additional courses in philosophy beyond the first year, can pretty well pick and choose whatever is available. So we have things that are offered now that no one would ever have thought of offering in the 1960s. I mean, we have a course in feminist philosophy, for example. No one ever heard of feminist philosophy in the 1960s. Maybe we should have. Some students take that, not very many. We have a rather full range now of courses in the history of philosophy, which we didn't have 30 years ago, because, for one thing, the departmental resources were pretty well stretched just giving the basic courses, since so many of them were required. We even have a course, I'm not sure whether it's been delisted or not, but if it has been delisted, this would have happened only recently. We had a course, maybe still do have a course in Canadian philosophy, which has never been taught. I put the course in the calendar about 20 years ago, 15 or 20 years ago, and one student enrolled the first year it was offered and dropped the course after one class, so we've never taught it. But there was no such thing as Canadian philosophy in 1961.
Yeah. Okay. So at the time that you came to the university, it was an all-male institution.
Yes.
Then in 68 it changed over and women were admitted on a full-time basis.
Yeah. Was it 68 that there was a formal change? Yeah. So Jocelyn Grassby got in, what, 67 was it?
Yeah.
Or 66? Yeah, the formal change, that's right. The formal change came during the second year of Father Lavelle's presidency. Mm-hmm. He came in 1967. And I'll just throw this in for data. You may already have run across it. But during the first several months of the Lavelle tenure, the Lavelle presidency, there was active but brief, and in the final analysis, fruitless activity having to do with the possible affiliation or relationship between Mount St. Vincent and St. Mary's.
Mm-hmm.
The formal decision to have St. Mary's become coeducational, I think, was a function of what I would call the failure of that particular enterprise. I don't say that had the enterprise not been undertaken, had St. Mary's continued, as indeed it has, as a separate institution from the Mount, that there would not have been, at some point, perhaps even about the same time, the decision made by St. Mary's to become coeducational. But I think the particular historical reality of it becoming coeducational at precisely that time, at least as far as I'm concerned, reflects the failure of some kind of formal agreement between Mount St. Vincent and St. Mary's.
Why was those negotiations, why were they a failure?
Why were they a failure? I have my own views, but I don't have sufficient evidence on which to rest anything more than a conjecture. I think that I'm not trying to be devious. I'm not reluctant to let you know what my views are. My hesitancy relates to the fact of my uncertainty with regard to my judgment. Let's put it this way. My guess, based on experience, is that in order for there to have been a satisfactory positive relationship formed between Mount St. Vincent and St. Mary's as post-secondary institutions, one of which was at the time under the total ownership of the Sisters of Charity, a female
Catholic religious community, and the other at the time under the what might be called the managership of a male Catholic religious order, which was hired by the Archdiocese of Halifax, for there to have been a full and complete understanding and agreement between those two groups would have taken longer than the time that was available. And things were moving very quickly at that particular time with respect to the formal character of not only those two institutions, but other institutions in the province and indeed in the country. The Sisters of Charity perceived clearly that the Mount was developing in ways that needed all sorts of activity, and subsequently they went out of the business. Mount St. Vincent is no longer the property of the Sisters of Charity. By the same token, the Archdiocese of Halifax and the Jesuits who were working for them at St. Mary's realized that the St. Mary's of old could not continue to operate in the way in which it had been for the last series of decades. So changes had to be made, and indeed changes were made very quickly. St. Mary's, for example, became an institution whose board of governors owned the institution rather than the Archdiocese within 2 or 3 years at that time. If the Sisters of Charity and the Jesuits, both of them having continued to operate their respective institutions, had had maybe 3 to 5 years to work out some kind of deal between themselves, I suspect that the Mount and St. Mary's might have come together. But the time had given, I would say in the first instance, lack of real experience with respect to the nature of universities and what universities are all about, principally on the part of the Jesuits, the need for decisions to be made quickly. In my view, that's the basic explanation for why they didn't get together.
Mm-hmm.
See, the Jesuits, particularly in Halifax, had very little experience with the operation of post-secondary institutions. That they had at that time, they had Loyola College in Montreal, which was a somewhat higher powered operation than St. Mary's. But basically they ran a couple of high schools and the Canadian Martyrs Shrine in Midland, Ontario. And they were not very strong on the ground with respect to well-qualified, competent, university-trained and aspiring to university-operating personnel. They just didn't have the people.
Mm-hmm. So what effect, how did the nature of the institution change after it came out of the administration by the Jesuits?
Well, St. Mary's saw itself and was seen in the community as essentially a Catholic post-secondary institution to provide education, post-secondary education, in the first instance for Catholics in the area, graduates of high school. The character of the institution in the first instance didn't change very much when the new University Act in 1970 came into effect.
except that the perception of the institution, both itself, in terms of its administration and in terms of the public, began to change. In a completely erroneous statement was made, began to be made at that time, about St. Mary's, namely that it had become a public institution. The implication being that previously it had been a private institution. Well, as far as I'm concerned, the description of the post-1970 St. Mary's as a public institution is a mistaken description in this sense, with respect to ownership of the legalities of the institution and its property and that notion of ownership. It is no more a public institution now than it was prior to 1970. The institution is owned by the Board of Governors. They're not a public body. The Board of Governors is constituted according to the 1970 St. Mary's University Act of a very specific group of people whose positions are guaranteed by the faculty elects 6 members of the Board of Governors. The Alumni Association elects, I think it's 4 members of the Board of Governors. The student body of St. Mary's elects 4. I mean, this isn't the public, is it? The institution, after 1970, could have continued to do whatever it damn well wanted to do, in the same way as prior to 1970, the university was owned by the Archdiocese of Halifax, which meant effectively that what went on at St. Mary's was what the Archbishop of Halifax and his archdiocesan advisors wanted to have go on. The present Board of Governors has as complete control of the university as had the Archbishop or the Archdiocese of Halifax prior to 1970. In what sense is it public? That is, how can anyone give any meaning to the notion that now it's a public institution, whereas prior to 1970 it was not? In this sense, and this I think is what most people understand calling St. Mary's a public institution nowadays. It's public in the sense that it's not exclusively Catholic. Could it have remained exclusively Catholic? Sure, it could have. Would this have resulted in it being any different now than it was in 1970? Probably it would be a lot closer now to what it was in 1970. With respect, let's say, to requirements for degree programs. I think the best thing to do to try and get some kind of fix on this sort of business is to take a look at the curriculum and course requirements at St. MX in comparison and contrast with St. Mary's, because you see, St. MX did not undergo any legal transformation some 20-odd years ago. Would someone call St. FX a Catholic institution rather than a public institution nowadays? Would you call it a Catholic institution?
No.
You wouldn't. Would it surprise you if someone said that it was a Catholic institution 20 years ago?
No.
No. Do you think it's much different now than it was then? You may or may not know.
No. Yeah.
Do you think that there are... And I ask these questions, mainly rhetorically, to kind of get a fix on things.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there are more required courses in philosophy and theology or religious studies at FX now than there are at St. Mary's?
Probably not.
Oh, I think you'd be wrong on that.
Really?
I think you'd be wrong on that. Mm-hmm. I know this to be the case in respect to philosophy courses, certainly in the arts degree program.
Really?
So what you're getting there is some kind of reflected retention of the notion that when you say it's not a public institution, you mean it contains more of a religious denominational aspect. But legally speaking, as I said a couple of minutes ago, St. Mary's is no different in terms of being public or private than it was a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. The perception, of course, is much different. The faculty have a much different perception of St. Mary's now than was the case in the 1960s.
Yeah.
Many faculty members who have come on board in the late 60s, before it underwent this legal change, and certainly who came on board post-1970, see the institution as not a Catholic institution. Many have no wish to see it in that fashion at all. Whatever the reflection was of this perception of St. Mary's as a Catholic institution prior to 1970 is something that the institution has had serious problems come to grips with in the last 20, 25 years. Mm. How successful it has been, I don't know. Can I get you more coffee?
No, I'm fine.
Sure, I'm going to help myself.
Okay.
I told you I would talk to you last
night. What changes have you noticed in the student population over the years in regards to, well, we discussed gender, but how about age and ethnic origin?
Well, age doesn't reflect itself in my perception as far as student body is concerned, except with respect to what I think is still a peripheral operation, even though there are larger numbers of students involved, that is, continuing education, part-time students. In those areas, certainly the number of students who are registered at St. Mary's, taking courses at St. Mary's, has increased, and their age, as you would expect, is older. The student body when I first came to St. Mary's was me to start with, and not very varied. You know, your average students for 3 or 4 years, whatever program they happen to be in, were students whose ages were 3 to 4 years post graduation from high school, so they were all youngsters. That's still true. Most of our students are youngsters. Most of the students whom I see or have seen, I won't see them anymore, in, let's say, first year philosophy course, most of them, the overwhelming percentage of them, are students who have just graduated from high school. Again, one or two older students, but not very many. So, from that perspective, no significant change. Not change in age. I think there's a very, to me, a very significant difference in attitude among the majority of students who come to St. Mary's now, and that is the students who are coming out of high school. We have a much broader approach to high school graduation nowadays than we did 30 years ago. A significantly higher percentage of students going through high school graduate than was the case 30 years ago. A significantly higher percentage of high school graduates go to university now than was the case 30-odd years ago. And that fact in itself, it seems to me, largely, but doesn't totally explain what I see as a considerable difference in attitude between students these days and students 30-odd years ago. And I'm trying to be descriptive here. You may want to get my evaluation of this later, but being purely descriptive, most of our students at St. Mary's now, this is true at Dalhousie, and Acadia, and FX, Toronto, elsewhere, see a university education as simply an extension of high school. And they see it largely, if not exclusively, in vocational terms. They want to go to university, they want to get a university degree, and because it is their perception, grounded on some evidence, that persons who have university degrees get better jobs and in the long run make more money than those who don't. That's an attitude which is much more widespread now than it was 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. The consequences for faculty and for many departments, it seems to me, in university, particularly in the arts and sciences faculties, is that your average student isn't really interested in learning very much. They're interested in getting credit, interested in getting a degree. Anything that smacks of a glint of being somewhat less than utilitarian tends to turn them off. You have to show a student nowadays that there's something in it for them in order to attract their interest and keep it, unless you happen to be a grandstand performer, and that's not difficult to do either. But you can't give them very much that they don't think is going to be worth very much to them. Mm-hmm. And that makes it difficult to teach some subjects. I don't say that the student is right to have this sort of attitude, except that the assessment of value within that perspective tends to be very short term. I mean, most of your students, and this is a cliche, but most of your students who become reflective at all on graduation, and lots of students don't, never reflect on their university career, but most of them who become reflective will concede that they learned some things, or they thought they benefited from courses A, B, and C that they thought were dreadful at the time they took them. I think most students 30 years ago were willing to reserve their judgment on these matters much more so than is now the case. I blame the universities. Here you see you're getting a value judgment. I blame the universities at least as much as I blame students for this sort of thing. Because we pander to this. Essentially, it's an illusion you're going to do better in the long run because you've got some kind of vocational approach to that. Another thing about the difference in students nowadays from 30 years ago, not much of a difference, but more of a difference now than was the case. This is more pronounced now than was the case 30 years ago. I find most of my students coming into the university, introductory, first-year students, have a desperately low opinion of their own abilities, especially with respect to what might be called hard subjects. They really don't think they can learn very much. They think, for example, philosophy is just terribly difficult. And they can't possibly do very well, and they won't make the effort. I used to tell students regularly, first week, that, you know, if they did the course, stayed the course, and did the work, that they would succeed. A very large majority of them don't believe that. So my failure rate has been about the same during my, 40 years, I guess, teaching. Somewhere between 35 and 40% first year. Yeah, well, it gets expressed differently nowadays. They drop the course.
They drop.
They drop the course.
Mm-hmm. Okay, something we haven't discussed yet is the unionization taking place in the 70s. Mm-hmm. What effect did that have on the nature of the school?
Improved it.
Improved it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In what ways?
Well, it built into the institutional system meaningful input from the professional academics that wasn't there before. And thereby, it seems to me, eliminated the need for faculty members, on average, rolling this kind of stone up the hill. We didn't need to roll it up the hill after we got terms and conditions of appointment that accepted us as professionals.
Mm-hmm.
That's why unionization improved a lot.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think it came about at that time? Because it was one of the first institutions to unionize.
Yeah, it certainly hasn't been the last.
No.
As I remember, there were probably only two or three other institutions in Canada that had unionized before St. Mary's did. One of which, I think the first unionized university or college in St. Mary's was a little two-bit Catholic place in Nelson, B.C. that had a terrible time dealing with the administration, which was quite benighted. Small institution, had no experience with professional academics in any large numbers. And this is what happened at St. Mary's. The institution got large, relatively large, a lot of new faculty members, and many of whom, of course, as new, had no particular security. They were young, they were getting started. It was at the time when all sorts of problems existed in larger Canadian and American institutions as to who was really running the place. Did the faculty run the place, or did somehow or other the government or the owners or the board run the place? I think the situation at St. Mary's was perfectly understandable at the time. What happened was perfectly normal. The institution, because of the legal change in 1970, became the property and under the direction of a new, brand new entity, a board of governors. Most, if not virtually all of whom, had no notion of how to run a university, no experience sitting on a board of governors of a university, weren't sure what a board was supposed to do, except they knew that they owned the place. Not unnaturally, as a relatively inexperienced group, saw the industrial commercial model as normal. You know, they knew the difference between employer and employees, and they thought rather simply that employers gave the orders and paid the employees, and the employees took the orders and took their money. Academics never really thought that was the way things should be. There was considerable movement in post-secondary institutions across the country and across the world, certainly the Western-speaking world, in the direction of making sure from the faculty side that that was not the way things should be. And with the relative inexperience, it seems to me, of the employers, that is the Board of Governors at St. Mary's, and the relative inexperience of faculty members, because so many of them were new and inexperienced, just fresh out of graduate school, the prospect of there being a confrontation between the two groups was pretty plausible. That's what happened. And insofar as the faculty, as a group, and it was very well organized as a group, came, however reluctantly, to the conclusion that they could not persuade the Board of Governors to reach an agreement with the faculty as a group. They simply exercised the option of going down the street, applying to the Labor Relations Board, and getting a status that required the employer to negotiate. I mean, a perfect illustration of this, I was reminded of it a month or so ago when I was cleaning out my office, got all sorts of files. You know how these things go, you look at some of them and you... A copy of an article, what was the manuscript of the article before it was actually a copy of the manuscript that I sent to University Affairs, which is the Canadian monthly or quarterly publication from the universities and colleges of Canada, I think it used to be called. I can't remember now exactly what the name is. Anyway, this was an article that the editor asked me to write about unionization in Canadian universities, 1971, 72, somewhere around in there. And I wrote that the article said, I thought that unionization was premature. Now, there are two extremes. One, the Board of Governors ran things and the faculty were employees. Well, that wasn't on. The other extreme, the union model. I thought that was an extreme. I thought it ought to be possible for faculty members to negotiate with sensible boards decent conditions, and there wouldn't be any need to go the unionization route, because, of course, unionization is a pretty crude model, because all of the legislation for unions still is. It's blue-collar industrial model legislation. But within, I suppose it would have been a couple of years after writing that article, we found ourselves at St. Mary's where we didn't think we had any option but to go the crude route. So that's what we did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.